The hour of 10:30 having arrived, I'm going to call to order the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Wolgamott, I think today you do have a motion for us.
Well, Mr. Chair, I attended our meeting on January 19th, 2023, and I had the opportunity to review the minutes from that meeting, and since I'm eligible to move them, I would like to make that motion.
Thank you, Representative Wolgamott. It's nice to know you attended that meeting. Any discussion to the motion by Representative Wolgamott on the minutes of the previous meeting?
Just very quickly, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I was saying just very quickly. Thank you for checking that before offering that. I appreciate that, and I'm glad you're back.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wolgamott.
Anything for you, Representative O'Neill.
All right. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Minutes are adopted. Members are going to continue where we left off last Thursday with the presentation on the budget by Minn State. So we had Vice Chancellor Mackey and Mary Rothschild, I think, were both up at the table. So if they want to return. Or, I'm sorry, we had Sasha Green, Stephen, and now we have Mary Rothschild. So we have a threesome up there. And I think, Vice Chancellor Mackey, you had just stopped. So if you want to once again introduce yourself for the record, and then we'll proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Bill Mackey, Vice Chancellor for Finance and Facilities. Before resuming the presentation, would like to acknowledge that Chancellor Devinder Malhotra and Board of Trustees Chair Roger Moe are also back for the presentation, as well as acknowledge some statewide student organization and bargaining unit leaders in the audience, and three of our presidents, President Scott Olson from Winona State University, President Sharon Pierce from Minneapolis College, and President Lori Clues from St. Cloud Technical and Community College. Also, I'd like to acknowledge that we are working on responses to some of the great questions that members had at last Thursday's meeting. And after today, if there's other questions that come up where we need to, we don't have the data readily accessible, we'll be providing all that information to the committee administrators for members. So I just wanted to acknowledge that we're still on top of some of those questions that arose last time. So resuming the presentation, we started talking about, as a system, what our total operating expenses are. And our total operating expenses for Minnesota State is $2.2 billion. And this is from our fiscal year 22 audited financial statements that were issued in November 2022. As you can see from the pie chart, 62% or about $1.38 billion is spent on salaries and benefits. That amount is usually about 70 to 80% of a college's and university's general fund budget. Also related to this chart, FY 2022 was an unusual year, as the financial aid number is much higher due to the influx of HERF funding that we received to benefit both our students as well as help with operating costs at our colleges and universities. As an example, just to illustrate that, in FY19, that salaries and benefit amount was 69%, the last full fiscal year prior to the pandemic. We spent a significant amount of time last week talking about the changes that have occurred over the last decade with college and university enrollment. And I want to spend a moment elaborating on some data I started providing at the end of last week's session. Is that also during the same time period, our total employee FTE has been reduced by about 11.5%. 8% of that reduction of 11.5% occurred between fiscal year 2013 and 2020, prior to the pandemic. One of the areas that we haven't seen as much reduction as of yet that we could potentially see is that the HERF funding provided a safety net for retaining as many of our faculty and staff as possible, as well as adding staff in certain high demand areas, particularly in serving our students. In addition, one of the guidelines that came from the Department of Ed related to the HERF funding, the Higher Education Emergency Relief funding, was to retain as much of your current faculty and staff as possible during the pandemic. So that definitely influences our numbers. And as our HERF funding goes away at the end of this fiscal year, if enrollment doesn't stabilize or increase for some of our colleges and universities, it's likely that there would be further reductions in faculty and staff and administrators. So during this time period, our total instructional faculty declined by about 13%. Our administrators declined by about 7%. We did have, in our staffing, we had various aspects where, and actually in some cases, staff increased, because over this time period, even though we had less students, we had more demands for student services, and we had more demands for technology. For example, the beginning of the implementation of our new ERP system brought on a whole new series of teams to help navigate that over the next couple of years. I also want to mention one non-operating expense that's not on this pie chart, but I know that is of interest to the committee, and it has to do with the user financing we currently pay for our capital projects, the one-third financing. And at the end of fiscal year 2022, we had an outstanding balance of about $171 million. Our annual debt service payment in 22 was about $27 million, which about $20 million of it was principal, and $7.5 million was interest. And that's about 1.9% of the college and university total state appropriation and tuition revenues. It varies by institution, but generally debt service is about 1 to 3% of a college and university's budget. And Associate Vice Chancellor will break this down further when presenting the FY23 capital program request to this committee on Thursday. Another way that we look at our expenses, and it's the same dollar amount, the $2.2 billion, is we look at it based on functional classifications. And this is a common language that's used in higher education in looking at how we group expenditures. As you can see from this pie chart, most of our expenses is spent on direct instruction, 38%, about $841 million. As we think about this and look at this pie chart, we look closely at instruction, academic support, and student services, the student facing functions, the direct service to students, whether it's instruction or student services, and that made up 64% of our expenses in fiscal year 2022. Again, the impact of this snapshot in time is influenced significantly by the amount of HERF funding that came from the federal government. So just to illustrate that point, in fiscal year 2019, that the amount of those three categories was 72%, 44% instruction versus 38%. Academic support was about the same at 13%, and student services was about the same at 14%. We expect that number to return back to that 70%+ as the scholarship and fellowships category of this data is about three times the normal amount due to the HERF grant. So in the top left of this, where it's 11% to about $234 million in scholarships and fellowships, that amount was $95 million in fiscal year 2020, just to illustrate my point. And just to provide a little definition behind some of these categories, academic support is functions of providing support for the academic side of the house for computing, administration, course and curriculum development, libraries, and other functions directly related to instruction. The student services component of it is what you might expect. It's areas such as career guidance, counseling, advising, financial aid, and many of our student life activities. The institutional support category of this slide, the $337 million on the right side, which is usually around this 12 to 15% range. Those are expenditures that relate to general administrative services, legal, fiscal operations, other functions that the colleges and universities and the system has that are not directly related to serving students, but are generally necessary to run our colleges and universities and our system.
Vice Chancellor, I think we have a question from Representative Colt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. Going back a little bit to your comments about FTEs, a couple of quick questions. Just sort of for my own edification, I'm assuming obviously you sort of keep track of FTEs. Are they classified in some way such that it's possible to make sort of an apples to apples comparison across institutions, so that if there's a certain classification of employees at, say, Normandale Community College, we'd be able to compare that number to, understanding obviously differences in missions and work and so on, to a similar classification at, say, Winona State. Is that correct?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter. Yes, that is correct. So our definition of what is a full-time equivalent faculty or staff member is defined in our statewide collective bargaining agreement. So it is administered in the same way across our colleges and universities.
Thank you. And then
Representative Colton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then would it be possible to get perhaps an overtime count of FTEs, potentially even broken down by institution? For the last few years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coulter, certainly we can provide that information. We have that available.
Thank you. I'd appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, when you made a reference to the number or the decline in the number of faculty or employees, do you make a distinction between those that are laid off and that those might be removed with an incentive for retirement, or is it just that individual's gone?
Mr. Chair, we do have detailed information based on how the FTE was reduced over that time period. We'll provide that data. We have it broken down by early retirement, whether it's a layoff. I would say the vast majority of the reductions occurs through not filling positions that become vacant, or reducing the level of part-time instructors due to the loss in enrollment and likely providing less courses due to that.
And then if you do have a need, you use adjunct faculty to fill that?
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe in many cases, many presidents and senior academic officers complement their staffing of their faculty by using adjunct and part-time faculty.
As someone who's been adjunct faculty for almost three decades, I just wanted to make that reference. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonilla.
Thank you. Since we did do a little pause here, I just have a quick question. I know that you as an institution negotiate directly with some of the unions and some of them you do not, that MMB actually negotiates. I don't know the breakdown. If we go back to the previous chart on page 8, do you happen to have that breakdown of the 1.3 billion in salaries and benefits? Do you happen to know what you negotiate and what you don't? If you don't, that's okay. You can get back to me later. But
Vice Chancellor Mack.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we can provide that salary data. I can give you a sense related to the FTEs, though, that helps provide some proportion to it. So, for example, in fiscal year 22, our largest bargaining unit was our two-year faculty at 3,885 FTE. The IFO had 3,112 FTE. And then our MUSAF unit had 764 FTE, and our administrators were 513 FTE, and those are the four units that Minnesota State directly negotiates. And that compares to our two largest classified units, or two units where we worked with through MMB. AFSCME was about 2,500 FTE, and MAPE was about 1,959 FTE.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, if you could get the dollar figure too, that's super helpful. Thank you. I know it's difficult for your system when you have, you don't have control over negotiations for, I mean, it's a significant amount, 4,000, a little over 4,500 or so employees. That's got to be a challenge. So I just wanted to know what the breakdown was. Thank you, Mr. Mackey.
I don't even know if this question is appropriate, so just shut me down if it's not appropriate. I'd like to follow the debate in the committee. I'm trying to understand the question that was just asked. I get the how many, I understand the basic question, how many are not, but I don't understand the full context of the question. Is there some insight that I could receive as to that?
I'll represent O'Neill, you want to respond?
It's totally up to the discretion. Yeah.
No, that's all right.
Yeah. Sure. So it's what I just said, which is it's a very large institution. It's $2.2 billion overall annual budget. And while they have control over four of their bargaining units that they directly negotiate with, including faculty and others, they don't negotiate AFSCME and MAPE contracts, which is negotiated by MMB in the state. And they typically, I've been on the SCR, so the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, I've been on it for nearly a decade and have chaired it in the past. And it's a challenge for any organization to not directly negotiate with the unions that work for them. And so AFSCME and MAPE are negotiated by MMB, so the state of Minnesota, the governor's office, essentially. And it's almost 4,500 employees that they don't directly negotiate with. And I just know that that is something in my 8 years or something working with higher ed that has been a challenge for this institution. And so I just didn't remember what the breakdown was between who they can directly negotiate with as their employees and who they cannot. And it's a challenge for them to manage budgets, because obviously they get money from students for tuition and they get money from the state, and they don't have other avenues for revenue. And so this is just a bigger picture of what do they have control over and what do they not.
Representative Cleburne, does that help?
Yes, thank you. I just, if they didn't have control over it, then it's not within their purview to say what it is, but I do now truly understand where you're coming from. So thank you very much for the clarification.
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we discussed last week, enrollment is an issue for many of our colleges and universities. And during the pandemic, enrollment declined at a faster pace. About a third, or 14,449 of the 42,000 FYE decline, occurred between fiscal years 2020 and 2022. And members, you have in your packet a breakdown by institution of the enrollment changes that have occurred between fiscal year 13 and fiscal year 2022. The data also shows that our students are taking less credits each year, as the full year equivalents are down by almost 28%, while the headcount is down by 22.5%, as we hear from our students as they struggle to balance other obligations, as well as the cost of attendance with their higher education pursuits and other factors. During this time period, college and university presidents and leadership teams have been making difficult decisions to reduce their operating budgets to adjust to having less operating revenue, but still trying to ensure they have the academic programs and student services that students need. Each one of our 26 colleges and 7 universities have their own story, how it directly relates to their current and projected enrollment and financial condition. Some colleges and universities have made substantial reductions in the last few years. Some are in process, and some are planning reductions in the next few years depending on the outcomes of enrollment and requests and new funding. During this time period, as I mentioned with our personnel changes, there's been more demand for student services, more technology to manage, and the fixed cost for the colleges and universities to have a certain level of programs and services are challenging and don't vary considerably based on enrollment. HERF funding has delayed reductions at some colleges and universities that may be considering based on that being fortunate to receive that funding in the fiscal year 20 to 22 time period. You heard from Chancellor Malhotra on all the work that is being done in this area to reverse this trend and how further investments from the state will allow the system to scale up services and initiatives that will help increase student success. We will now address how our biennial budget request supports these enrollment management strategies to increase student success as well as produce more graduates that Minnesota State puts into the workforce.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, just stay here for a second. We're looking at a chart that's, I guess, now called nationally the enrollment cliff, and it is not a problem just in Minnesota, it's a problem nationally. Do we know, and if you don't, you don't need to answer today, how would Minnesota compare to other states or a national average on enrollment decline? Are we a little bit better or a little worse?
Mr. Chair, can I defer to Senior Vice Chancellor Satasha Green-Steven, who's our lead in enrollment management, the system?
Vice Chancellor Green-Steven.
Thank you, Chair. We're on average with national average. We are a little bit above average as it relates to our transfer rates on success with transfer, but in terms of enrollment, we are on par with national numbers.
All right. Thank you.
So as has been stated, our colleges and universities rely on state appropriation as their primary funding source to cover their general fund operating budget. An increase in base state appropriation is needed for Minnesota State colleges and universities to continue to provide an exceptional education and ensure there are adequate programs and services to serve our students. Without increases in general fund revenues, campuses will need to continue to reduce the breadth of academic programs and student services that are available to students at the same time some of these demands are increasing. Among the side effects of the pandemic that's also putting pressure on our operating funding has been the resurgence of inflation due to supply and demand issues and increase in labor costs due to shifts and shortages in labor market participation. Our colleges and universities have navigated that by reassessing and reallocating spending on a continual basis to maintain a focus on student success and other priorities while doing the best they can to preserve affordability. This request of $125 million for continuing operation includes $40 million in fiscal 24 and $85 million in fiscal 25. This would be an increase of over 6% for the amount allocated directly to colleges and universities and an increase of 3% for some system-wide functions that are performed centrally on behalf of colleges and universities, such as enterprise technology, library services, and the system office. Some of these functions have not received inflationary funding for several years. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to now turn the presentation over to Senior Vice Chancellor Satasha Green-Steven to talk about the student support portion of our budget
Vice
request.
Chancellor Mackey, I have a Representative McDonald has a question.
Mr. Chair, thank you. A question for the Vice Chancellor. In your remarks about the needed funding to continue the all the academic programs, in the literature that you provided last week, there's over 4,000 programs, 4,023. Your website actually says 3,400 and some, so there's a something's off there. But anyway, I'll digress to the sheet here. So with the 4,023, is that many courses necessary? Is there anywhere out of those 4,000 courses over 54 campuses that you have looked at that probably aren't really performing well or not many students are taking part that you could cut or eliminate, therefore you wouldn't need that extra $125 million? Not saying that you don't need that now, but is there any room in over those 4,000 programs that just aren't working anymore and the numbers are just futile and it's not necessary, therefore saving the taxpayers' dollars and your institutions as well for some funding deficiencies.
Vice Chancellor Mack.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, our presidents and their leadership teams have a regular ongoing process of evaluating their academic program portfolio. And there are programs that are suspended, closed, and then added on an annual basis depending on what the demand is. So that's a very fluid number and it's an ongoing process. One of the challenges we have from a financial perspective related to this, and I'll give a specific example from my campus experience, is that you may have a program in your region, a career and technical program that serves many of the employers. And that program may have a cohort of 25 students to be a full program. And we've been seeing in some cases with some programs that number drops, and it drops down to 20 or it drops down to 18. And so you have a 20% reduction in enrollment in a particular program, but you still have the demand and you have the need for it. So many of these programs and classes that we have, we're not quite at full capacity, but the demand and the need is still there. So we're seeing more financial stress by not having as many students in some of the classes that perhaps we did have in the 2011 or 2013 time period. But as far as the review of academic programs, that is an ongoing basis, and we continually see changes that occur in those portfolios across the system.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, just quick follow-up. Thank you. Thank you for that remark. Certainly makes sense as you reevaluate the programs, and certainly you wouldn't want to eliminate any program that had a demand or need based upon a fluctuation of students from year to year, because that's going to change. But is there any room of those programs, the over 4,000, that there's no demand and no need and just are obsolete or just simply don't make sense in today's day? Perhaps there's not. I'm just asking you.
Mm-hmm. Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I would speculate that presidents are evaluating that, and if there are programs that meet that category, they're being evaluated, and they may be part of the programs that are suspended or closed in the future.
Representative McDonald. All right. Vice Chancellor Mackey, you're going to shift over.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Pulaski, and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dr. Satasha Green-Steven, the Senior Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, and I'll go over three categories of our budget request. We know a big part of enrollment management, more specifically, retention of our students, is affordability, the cost of education. And we know that the cost of education has a direct impact on if a student can begin as well as continue their education. So we're proposing $125 million to support student affordability and tuition freeze. That would be $50 million in FY 2024 and $75 million in FY 2025. An ongoing and a persistent theme in our listening sessions and from our student organizations is student affordability, that cost to attendance. It's a key factor in students' decision-making about a college or a university education. So a tuition freeze would support students in their education and would be consistent with past legislative limitations on undergraduate tuition and would be in lieu of the 3.5% increase each year, not only supporting our current students but future students who may not be able to afford or have the capability to attend now, have an opportunity to access higher education. This would save our students $25 million in FY 2024 and at $50 million in FY 2025. When we look at national data, it also shows students' concerns about education costs. A recent national study by the Gates Foundation found that, one, students are concerned about the cost of education, and two, they have questions about the value of post-secondary education. And then lastly, many are worried about disrupting their livelihood to attend colleges and universities. Because of the cost of attendance is beyond just tuition, there are costs of course materials. This can also be an added investment for students to stop out of education for the tuition they need to pay. Expanding our educational resources, our Z degrees, those complete zero cost, no cost course materials, these Z degrees costs will help lower the overall cost of attendance and would save students additional out-of-pocket costs. Minnesota State Z Degrees Project saved students a little bit over $1.5 million in textbook costs in year 2021, and we have estimated a total $3.5 million by academic year 2023. And through the collective work of system office in our colleges and universities in the system, we've successfully built upon existing efforts to expand the use of open education resources. During our continued OER expansion efforts, Minnesota State has continued to prepare and support our faculty, our staff, and our libraries, including providing opportunities of incentives for our faculty to identify, review, and adapt, create, and share, and adopt open education resources. And finally, the state legislature's financial support was critical to our OER and Z degree development. Future financial support ensures that Minnesota State colleges can continue to implement new, sustain, and expand our Z degree opportunities. And Minnesota State strongly believes this support is critical to ensuring success to course resources, which ultimately promotes student success and degree attainment.
Vice Chancellor, I'm going to pause for a second. Representative Hicks, you have a question.
I just wanted to check in on the Z degrees. Thank you, Chair. I've heard such great things. Could you give us some examples of what are some of the resources that are in those Z degree programs in replacement of textbooks? I know for me, I didn't understand it initially.
So, Vice Chancellor Green Stevens.
Thank you, Chair, Representative. So we worked with a community of faculty, and really open education resources are opportunities to use articles, opportunities to use different resources in the library versus purchasing sometimes those costly textbooks. But finding different resources that are available for students to still be able to meet the course student learning outcomes without having to buy a costly textbook. And so there's some faculty have incorporated videos, some have incorporated research-based articles, some have incorporated different resources from the library. And so depending on the course, you have a variety of resources and tools that support students in their learning.
Thank you so much.
But before we proceed, I just want to go back to 2013 for a bit here. In 2013, this committee and the chair of the committee at that time was proposing a tuition freeze. And the then system fought the House all the way through conference committee, all the way to the governor's desk, and then Governor Dayton finally did sign a tuition freeze. And I think I know what's changed, so I want to make a statement that I welcome the new Minn State with the new chancellor and the new trustees and the insight that they now have that at least some members of the legislature had a decade ago. Proceed.
Second, we're proposing $26 million to support student support services. A big part of student success is having those student supports inside and outside of the classroom, and has a direct impact on enrollment and student retention. Even prior to the pandemic, student support services and basic needs supports had been a focus of our work. The pandemic only amplified the importance of student supports. In the fall of 2018-2019, 20 Minnesota State colleges and universities participated in the Real College Survey administered by the Hope Center for College and Community and Justice at Temple University. The Real College Survey is the nation's largest annual assessment of basic needs security among college students. Approximately 9,800 Minnesota State students participated in this survey, and the data revealed rates of basic needs insecurity that mirrored national data. The study also revealed, consistent with the national data, rates of basic need insecurity were disproportionately experienced by students of color, students of Native origin, and students with our other underrepresented identities. Additional research from the Hope Center has suggested mental health concerns among students continue to rise, and unexpected financial emergencies continue to pose a threat to the ability of our students to persist to graduation. This funding would support Minnesota State colleges and universities in investing in those supports. And this is not an exhaustive list, but would support in advisors, transfer specialists, social workers, mental health support staff, basic need coordinators, in ways that make sense for our campus communities and in ways to address their highest needs. It also would provide ongoing support for basic needs connection hubs, which provide round-the-clock access for our students. It would expand our mental health supports, a critical and growing need, to provide a similar 24/7 resource, and expand the training we've rolled out to our faculty and staff to recognize and provide an initial response to students' mental health needs. Again, supporting students inside and outside of our classrooms.
Vice Chancellor, I'm going to pause again. Representative Scott, and I have one other member after Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski. To the testifier, I see transfer specialists on this list, and I know that there was a lot of hubbub recently, and maybe it was the recent past, about transfer of credits to our larger, you know, institutions, four-year institutions. Could you kind of give us an update on what your work has been recently to improve that situation?
Vice Chancellor Green-Stevens.
Thank you, Chair. A representative, yes. We really have prioritized transfer. And some of the things that we're working on is what we call our transfer pathways, where a student can complete 60 credits at our 2 years, and then get junior standing at one of our four-year institutions, and then be able to complete their degree with it at 60 plus 60. And so we've really done an audit on that. One of the things that we're implementing at the system level is a program review process. Typically, program review has happened on campus, but we've elevated that to the system office. And we started in 2027, 2028, we began to review and evaluate our transfer pathways. We started with our pilot programs. We brought faculty community of practice from our 2 years and 4 years to come together to see what was working in our transfer pathways and what wasn't working, and then provide recommendations to how to remediate that. We've done that for the last couple of years. Last semester, we did 4 additional programs. In the fall, we'll do 2 more. So we've implemented an evaluation for our transfer pathways. Secondly, what we're doing, too, is we have a transfer governance team, which is a stakeholder group that's at the system level with students, administrators, as well as our bargaining units that come together to talk about issues of transfer. They oversee our transfer programs, and they've also helped to provide recommendations of how we can make seamless transfer for our students. So our transfer pathways, implementing our transfer governance teams, as well as coming up with an accountability model for transfer, that group is also charged with working on.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Pulaski. And thanks for that update. Has the response from students been positive, or is it still too early to tell?
Vice Chancellor.
Chair, thank you, Representative Scott. It's a bit too early to tell, but preliminary data is, you know, students do want us to expand our transfer pathways. They want more opportunity. We have 26 content areas, and so our goal is to expand that in more content areas. So students definitely want to be able to transfer seamlessly from our 2 years and 4 years. And so a part of our work is to expand those programs. And so we use a lot of deed data, and we also use another service, Gray's Associates, to look at market need. And that helps us to make data-driven decisions about not only market need, but students' desires. And so that will help support us in the areas that we will expand in our transfer pathways.
Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About not this last December, but the previous December, myself and Senator Rarick decided to go on vacation. And instead of vacation, we actually toured a whole bunch of in-state colleges and went back to my alma mater and went to Bemidji State. And I really wanted to learn what the American Indian Resource Center did. It was fascinating. And being from that area, it was just, it was like another world that I just wish every campus had that for particularly American Indian students or Native American Indian students. Now, I should say they call it American Indian, so I'm not trying to be offensive. That's literally what they call it, so I'm not mischaracterizing that. But my question is, in this $26 million, will some of that go to that resource center that's at Bemidji State and many, and if there, I don't even know if there are others like it, but if there are others like it, because that wraparound service really was the difference between the success of the Native students and failing and dropping out.
Vice Chancellor Green-Steven.
Chair, Representative O'Neill. The great thing about this ask, it really will be campus-led, and so the campus would be able to determine where the resources go. And so if Bemidji State President Hoffman would see fit, those resources would go to that center, that's where that's the dollars would go. And I would also say that with this, the center in Bemidji, it also is a shared service and would also support our system. And so there's an opportunity for all students across our system to engage with that center.
Thank you.
Proceed.
So third, we are proposing $12 million in transfer, $12 million in emergency grants. $10 million in emergency grants. Additional funding for emergency grants prior to the pandemic, the demand for emergency support often exceeded the available funding. Proposed funding would provide for crucial support where student vulnerabilities can delay or derail academic and career progress, as well as help support addressing needs that represent barriers to students achieving their educational goals. These emergency grants would be locally customized, promptly awarded funds to help for unforeseen emergencies. The entire process would be available on a mobile app that is administratively streamlined, easy to use, and focused on need and equity in decision making. Additionally, the ease of application and speed of disbursement are important factors in getting students the supports they need when they need it. And then lastly, we're proposing $12 million in transfer scholarships, supporting affordability for students to make the transition from our two-year college to our four-year universities. We'll support the persistence and completion of students who attend our colleges and transfer to our universities. Paired with our ongoing work on transfer pathways and ongoing improving the transfer experience for students, this will help sustain and expand Minnesota State's college to university pipeline. We're proposing funding two transfer scholarship programs. First, our transfer pathways. Transfer pathways makes it easy to complete a specific associate degree at a Minnesota State college and transfer to a Minnesota State university to earn a baccalaureate degree. It's an easy way to save time and money without losing credits and taking extra courses, along with flexibility to attend classes on campus or online. Our second transfer scholarship program would be Minnesota State Transfer Guarantee. Students who would complete an AA, AS, or AFA degree from any Minnesota State college are guaranteed admission to one of our seven Minnesota State universities. Students must meet special admission requirements for the major and not guaranteed admission into the major itself. This collaboration ensures that students can seamlessly and reliably transfer from Minnesota State colleges to Minnesota State universities. The guarantee saves students money by taking advantage of the lowest tuition rates in Minnesota at Minnesota State colleges and university. Tuition and fees at Minnesota State are significantly lower than other higher education options within the state, and students receive an associate's degree on their way to their baccalaureate degree. And to note, this, these scholarships would be last dollar in scholarships.
Vice Chancellor, Representative Robbins has a question.
Thank you, Chair Bielski. Thank you, Vice Chancellor. I just wondered about how many students already use this program, how many students does it serve, and what's the average amount of a scholarship in either pathway?
Vice Chancellor Green-Steven.
Chair, Representative, I don't have those numbers with me, but we can get those back to you. But I will say with our transfer pathways, our 26 transfer pathways, those are the degrees. Even though they're called transfer pathways, when we implemented those, any standalone degree was sunset. So if you enter, for example, business, you have to enter a business transfer pathway. And so those are replacing the standalone degrees. But I can get those, we can get those numbers to you.
All right, proceed.
I will turn it over to my colleague, Mary Rothschild, to talk about workforce development.
Representative McDonald has a question, so while we're pausing.
Mr. Chair, we're transitioning a question for the senior vice chair. So you're asked for $77 million for this tuition freeze and affordability. Should you not get that full amount, because there's only a finite amount of money that going around, even with a almost $18 billion surplus, is your priority still to then freeze tuition to make it affordable for students?
Vice Chancellor, do you want to respond? Vice Chancellor Mackey, or who wants to respond to that one?
I'll defer to my colleague.
All right.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, what has historically happened is at the end of the session and when it's determined how much new funding a Minnesota State receives, the board would evaluate their options for setting tuition and fees and approving our operating budgets after we see where we end up. So we wouldn't we usually the motion when we pass our biennial budget specifically talks about the board's authority to setting tuition and fees at the conclusion of the session, and we determine the results.
Representative McDonald, I think the translation is tuition would go up.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And as the tuition would be, go up, what, 3.5%? Is that what I saw on the slide? Is that right?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Chair Pelosi, Representative McDonald, 3.5% was the amount that the board had as a maximum for undergraduate tuition in the 22-23 biennium. So that amount, that 3.5% increase, was used to cost out the price of this tuition freeze. Whether that was an amount or a different amount would be determined after session.
Representative McDonald.
I'm sorry, I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Whether that 3.5 was the amount or it was a different amount wouldn't be determined until after session.
Representative McDonald?
Yeah, I won't belabor that. What does that mean? I mean, why did you have that number in the first place if it's going to be determined after session? Is that just a kind of a placeholder, if you will?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, this budget request, all components of it are intertwined. So the amount of funding that Minnesota State and the colleges and universities received for the $125 million for stabilization, as well as how much funding that would either be a funded tuition freeze or offset a projected tuition increase, all of those factor in what a tuition or what the price might be in fiscal year 24 and 25. So it isn't just focused on that $75 million. The stabilization of $125 million has a significant influence on that policy decision as well.
And I'll just end on this. So just based upon your state colleges of the tuition is average of 6,109, and that's less before grants and scholarship. If you added 3.5, that's just what I did with simple math, but I'm from Watertown, so don't hold that against me. So that's about a $213.80 increase for that student if it's at 3.5%. Divided by 365, that's less than a cup of coffee a day. So I'm just curious, the reason I'm asking that is there's nothing wrong with a little bit of increase for a student to pay for a product that he's buying, in my humble opinion. We all have to pay more for products from eggs, or what, $8 now almost? So I don't have a problem personally, and suppose some students will not like the comment, but you have to pay a little bit more for what you're buying. So inflation is here with us, and if a student has to pay a little bit more, $213 for a two-year or per year for 2 years, that seems fair enough if you don't get your request, if that is based upon that 3.5%. Maybe I'm not making any sense, but again, one voice, no problem with students paying a little bit more for education if you don't get your ask. That's just the way the world works. What would you say to that, Chancellor?
Vice Chancellor, I don't know if you necessarily need to respond, but you may.
Mr. Chair, Representative McDonald, I understand what you just went through, the calculation. I would add that what we've clearly heard from our students, and tuition fees are a component of the cost of attendance for students attending one of our institutions. We've continually heard there's stress on all components of the cost of higher education. And as we consider it, the tuition freeze is a component of that, but there's other costs that Minnesota State doesn't control that directly impact the students' attendance, whether it's childcare, whether it's transportation, the cost of living, housing, and other things like that. So we heard loudly on these listening sessions that we mentioned, as well as through the consultative process from our students, that we need to do a better job of lowering the overall cost of attendance to ensure there are more students participating in higher education.
All right, proceed.
Chair Pelosi and members of the committee, for the record, I am Dr. Mary Rothschild, and I am the Senior System Director for Workforce and Economic Development. I work with many of our programs at the state colleges and universities to support our state's labor market and our economy. These programs include continuing education, customized training, career and technical education, including the management of our state's $20 million federal Perkins grant, are 8 centers of excellence and many programs that support working learners and adults access higher education. In general, our focus is not only educational disparities, but economic disparities. Before I review our workforce request, I'd like to add, as Chair Moe and Chancellor Malhotra mentioned last Thursday, that the systems listening sessions provided an echo chamber for how important skilled workers are to the state's future business growth. And the find us more refrain. With the lowest unemployment rate in the country, it is vital we collaborate with our K-12 school districts, business and industry, and foster the most innovative learning environments we can. Our campuses consult with their employer communities regularly, and employers also emphasize the importance of increasing quality, non-degree training opportunities to serve adults and to remove financial barriers to skills training. Minnesota State's request for workforce and economic development is focused on both the quality and the competitiveness of our programs. Our community and technical colleges, in addition to our state universities, directly compete with students with our bordering states. With 64% of our two-year college students in career and technical education programs, I estimate that at least 11 of our 26 colleges directly compete for these students. That's a lot. Minnesota must retain a competitive edge through quality instruction, equipment, and affordability. Some of the goals we've identified for this funding include to have nearly half of our career and technical education students earn an industry-recognized or high-quality non-degree credential along with their academic degree to help their immediate employment prospects. We expect to increase the number of employer-sponsored educational programs, including internships, applied research, and earn and learn opportunities. We expect to increase retention in STEM fields in both two-year and four-year programs, and most importantly, maintain employer satisfaction with the skills of our graduates and the quality of our equipment and facility. That leads to the largest part of our request, $49 million over the biennium, to support state-of-the-art skills training labs and applied learning environments. These funds are different from our capital programs, which can take years to fund, and our existing small leveraged equipment program that serves only a portion of the needs. This funding will be focused on new technologies, such as simulation labs for healthcare, introducing students to artificial intelligence software technologies, as well as lab capacity for college and university students in the STEM fields. Just an example, our agriculture centers of excellence have provided evidence that our neighboring states of North and South Dakota and Iowa have made significant investments in equipment and facilities for high-tech, regenerative, precision agricultural training. And in some cases, high schools in those states exceed the quality of the equipment in Minnesota's colleges. Agriculture students today must be introduced to the equipment and software that assess environmental impacts, such as soil health, but that is balanced with efficient food production. This makes the equipment often large in size and scale, and our colleges do not currently have the ability to purchase, let alone house, such equipment. The second part of our request is to grow our highly successful workforce development scholarship program. This funding will offer a more affordable education to more students in high demand fields of healthcare, information technology, agriculture, transportation, manufacturing, and early childhood education, as well as add 3 new high demand fields for students in construction, public safety, and education. Over the 4 years of the existing program, we have supported nearly 8,500 students with these scholarships, but that served only a very small fraction of the 200,000 students who have attended in that same 4-year timeframe. This program will make it easier for our state university students to affordably complete their 4-year degrees and allow our adult workforce to keep skills up to date by adding professional continuing education certifications and credit for prior learning fees, as eligible for the use of these scholarship funds. The last part of the workforce request is to develop and expand industry sector programming. Our existing 8 centers of excellence in healthcare, IT, manufacturing and engineering, energy, transportation, and agriculture have made a tremendous impact on our partnerships with business and industry, improving the quality of our education through direct guidance on programs and helping many young people experience intensive career exploration, such as our Scrubs camps sponsored by the Healthcare Center of Excellence. Addressing the needs for more healthcare workers, particularly nurses, is an important objective of this proposal. In manufacturing, as another example, faculty have indicated that they would like to offer, for example, a basic electronic certification for high school students or more options for on-the-job training. Just a few examples of the kinds of program enhancements. By supporting industry sector programming and adding 2 new centers in construction and public safety, Minnesota State will be more responsive to the emerging multidisciplinary skills needed for future careers, offering students greater access to internships, short-term certificates, high school to college pathways, and other applied learning opportunities. So in conclusion, I'd like to address the issue of enrollment and the contribution of workforce funds.
Director Roth, I'm going to pause for a second. Why would you need to establish 2 new centers of excellence to do what you just said you were going to do? Why does a center of excellence have to be created to do this?
Chair Pawlowski, our centers of excellence are unique collaborations of our colleges and universities that permit us to have a single point of contact for our employers. So the benefits that we've seen by having our centers is that we have a statewide industry or employer advisory committee, and we reach more colleges and universities through the voices of those employers as a single point of contact for all of the colleges and universities in our system. So our colleges and universities are partners in the centers, and then the employer voice can contribute directly to the quality of our programming and the needs through a center. It creates greater efficiencies, is what I would say, in the way we conduct our programs.
So, Director Rothschild, is there any increase in administration in a center of excellence?
Chair Pawlowski, our centers of excellence run on a fairly modest model of operations. They typically have an executive director, a K-12 outreach coordinator, and an employer coordinator. And so about 3 staff is what it takes to run a center on behalf of all of our colleges and universities across the system.
Director Rothschild, I'm a little perplexed why we need to create a center of excellence to do a job that should be done by the current administration, mm-hmm. whether that is a 2-year college or a 4-year university, particularly at a time when you have declining enrollment. And in that declining enrollment, there must be a few administrators that would have a little bit less to do with fewer students. So I've always looked at these centers of excellence with a little, shall we say, critical eye. Mm-hmm. Creating more administration in higher education, I don't think solves the problem that we're looking at here, particularly with the declining enrollment that's been going on. Representative Colter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt, but it seemed like a good time to do just that, I guess. Could you go back to the slide on the workforce development scholarships? I'm having a little trouble understanding the first 2 bullet points. So maybe you could, maybe the simplest way to ask this question is what is the current state of the workforce development scholarships? What's the current maximum award? And then what is your proposal to change that?
Okay. Chair Pawlowski and Representative, the current program is funded at $4.5 million per year, and the eligibility is defined as for a student who are in an eligible program area. They are eligible for $2,500 for an academic year at a two-year college. So that's $1,250 per term. And if they choose, the current program is, if they continue their education in the same program area as a transfer student from that college to one of our state universities, they're eligible for an additional $2,500 for that third year, essentially junior standing at a state university. The change to the program would permit us to directly award a $3,500 scholarship to a university student, depending on, and they could be either a first year freshman student or a transfer student. And so the eligibility isn't dependent on transfer. It would be eligible, it'd be more based on whether they are enrolling in one of these high demand occupational program areas, either at the outset or as a transfer student. The increase in the amount just reflects the different cost of instruction at a state university versus a two-year college.
Representative Culp.
Thank you. I think it was the transfer piece that was throwing me off. So thank you.
Representative Cleveland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I'm going to maybe the same question that you were asking, but a little differently about this Center of Excellence for the Building Trades. And also you mentioned, well, I'll just say it this way. So the question I would have is for the electrical workers that I think you mentioned, an electrical certificate, if I think I heard you say that or not. Would that be, I think you mentioned nurses and electricians mm-hmm. as you were giving your description. So my question about the electricians, would that be through a PSEO offering or would that be through an institutional offering for college age students? So are we talking about high school students, PSEO, or are we talking about adults in your institution? That's the first question.
Director Rothschild.
Chair Pawlowski and Representative Cleburne, the example that I was giving could be offered to both high school students through a post-secondary enrollment option, mm-hmm. Or it could be for adults. So I was simply referring to, actually in this case, it wasn't necessarily for electricians, but electronics, which is typically a manufacturing occupation. And so the idea would be to provide exposure to high school students as well as a certification that they could use perhaps once they completed their high school degree and it would have value in the employment market for both continuing their education or as a direct employment opportunity.
Representative Kleber.
And thank you for that clarification, the difference between electrics and electronics, very different. Thank you. And then my question about adding a center of excellence for construction and building trades, I'm just wondering if there has been consideration as to whether or not, I'm thinking about IUPAT has an associate's degree and then you can go on to a construction management degree mm-hmm. through the union at no cost to the student. So I'm just wondering if in fact we aren't setting up a program that could be available to a student without cost through the trade unions. And that's just a general.
Yeah. Director Rothschild.
Yep. Chair Pawlowski and Representative Cleburne. We do know that our trades unions provide an excellent opportunity for people to be employed as an apprentice mm-hmm. and to continue their education through affiliated training with our colleges and universities, as well as the occupational training they receive from the union. What we've found is that many of those individuals are accepted into those apprenticeship programs only after they have a two-year or maybe a diploma at our community or technical college. They're very competitive programs, and so actually allowing some student, creating opportunities for individuals to be educated at a college or university makes them more likely to receive or to be part of an apprenticeship program. Your question about construction management and the opportunities that might exist, those are specifically a four-year degree that is often based, there are requirements for physics and other advanced mathematical and business skills. We do have a transfer program for construction management already, but I'm not familiar with what the unions offer that would be competitive with that. But that would be part of what a center would do, is statewide look very carefully at the demand for programs, and in partnership with a business and industry advisory council, make the appropriate decision so that we don't have redundancies in our educational offerings, and we offer the most efficient offerings. So perhaps that could be an online degree or something like that.
And just that, I agree with you, there's space for both, right? One does not necessarily replace the other. I'm just looking at it through the lens of cannibalization of each program, right? And to make sure that we have enough for either both to be successful or one to be successful. Yeah. And that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Rothschild, I think just wanted to get clarification. This registered apprenticeship through the Department of Labor and Industry, or it's not a registered apprenticeship?
Director Rothschild.
Yeah. Chair Pulaski and Representative Noor. The Minnesota State Department of Labor and Industry is the only agency that can offer registered apprenticeships. Minnesota State is an aligned training partner for the academic programming that is part of a registered apprenticeship program. The other program that we participate in is the Pipeline program, which is dual education and is not a registered apprenticeship. Looking at that as an option for many students might be valuable. Again, in the construction and building trades, we would want to do that very carefully in conversation and in consultation with the hiring needs for those construction trades, not replicate a registered. We have no ability to offer registered apprenticeship programs. I hope I answered your question. If not, please clarify.
I think there'll be more conversation on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question that I have is, do we have an innovation and technological hub, you know, taking advantage of the federal program that the CHIPS and Science Act that was passed, meaning that we have to be competitive. We want to create more talent in that field. Are we really looking just beyond what we have in terms of developing those innovation centers within the MinSTEAM?
Thank you, Chair Pulaski and Representative Noor. Innovation, I think, is at the heart of our request here for these program areas that will look at the need to stay current with our manufacturing, engineering, energy, transportation. All of those industries are advancing at light speed. And so the purpose of our request is to permit our colleges and universities to stay competitive. Interestingly, we had a conversation this morning with Greater MSP and the CHIPS proposal that we hope to make to the federal government. Minnesota State will be a key partner in providing education for vacuum technologies, for precision manufacturing, biomedical manufacturing. So we hope to be a key partner with the state of Minnesota and Greater MSP on an application.
One final question, Mr. Chair. In relation to that, we have the Minnesota Business Partnership, which the chancellor is also a member of the board, and some of the institutions work with the industry based partnership to provide training for the workers, meaning that through the Department of Labor and Industry, we do fund the institutions, most of the MinSTEAM, so that they can partner with the employers. Is that factored into the workforce economic development piece?
Yeah.
Director Rothschild.
Chair Pulaski and Representative Noor, I might have to clarify, are you referring to the Minnesota Job Skills Partnership Program?
Mr. Chair, Dr. Rothschild, yes.
Okay.
Dr. Rothschild.
Yes. Minnesota, that was a conversation this morning with Greater MSP to perhaps have a specialized program, which would be a partnership between our colleges and universities for direct workforce training for those chips manufacturers and the collaboration of chips manufacturers. Minnesota State is the recipient of probably 85 to 90% of all Minnesota Job Skills Partnership grants currently. And most of the awards for those grants are in the manufacturing space. So we have a very deep and tight relationship to supporting our manufacturers in the state of Minnesota through that program and the Department of Employment and Economic Development.
Representative Noor.
I didn't want to ask this other question, but knowing that you discussed about the not only the workforce challenges, but also the disparities in the workforce itself, how are we trying to diversify and attract, you know, more individuals from BIPOC communities to take, advantage of this program so that they can be gainfully employed, so they can have a living wage with benefits and also talent that is required in the workforce today?
Director Rothschild.
Chair Pulaski and Representative Noor, we have a very intentional and focused effort on our adult learners and our partnerships with our community-based organizations. So the system office has been working with many of our national organizations, the Lumina Foundation, the National Skills Coalition, and many other organizations to provide direct pathways from community-based education, from Goodwill Easter Seals, Hired, Clues, all of these organizations to create direct pathways for our adult learners from diverse communities to be college-ready and employment-ready. And so I'd be happy to come back and spend a lot of time on how we have done those programs. St. Paul College has a very robust program, direct alignment with International Institute, et cetera. So there are lots of examples where we have asked our community and technical colleges in particular to create those alignments of academic programs.
Representative Nerp, is that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is really more of a comment, maybe a placeholder, and I know that you've had conversations with our K-12 chairs, but I'm wondering how much of some of this vocational stuff could be put back in our high schools.
Representative Scott, you are now stealing my question, and I was going to raise it. We are in the midst of planning a joint meeting with K-12 Finance, and you are going to be on the agenda, but I would like a much more narrow focus from you as to how we can reestablish that connection. We're also inviting the Chamber and the Business Partnership and others to participate in this, and we'll have several planning meetings in my office, but I agree. There has to be in this budget a much more focused approach on how you're going to do it without increasing administration. Mm-hmm. And that's both at the K-12 level and at yours.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Thank you. I do just have a few concluding remarks, which I think will address, Chair Pulaski, your question here, and that is how the issue of enrollment and how that will be addressed through the workforce development aspects of this. So certainly our workforce development scholarship program is intended to be a recruitment tool to our high school students in high-demand occupations. Many colleges use the scholarships to ensure students can afford and assist in covering their non-tuition costs, such as books, materials, transportation. Industry sector funding will support outreach efforts to high schools, including industry certifications in high school, summer internships, earn and learn models, and new partnerships for employee training. Career and technical faculties strongly endorse this funding in support of our high school programs, as indicated in their current active involvement in our centers of excellence. High school students face challenges in understanding advanced technology jobs and accessing career and technical education in high school. So the funding will support more program pathways through post-secondary enrollment and concurrent enrollment in CTE fields. And last, I just want to mention, again, the federal Perkins program. Minnesota State is the state administrator of this program, and it plays a vital role in the future of career and technical education. 85% of the federal funding, or $17 million, is distributed to secondary schools. Every school is in partnership with a two-year college, and they provide career and technical education to between 150 and 200,000 students annually. For those students who complete a CTE set of courses, 92% graduate from high school and 65% continue on to college. So, apropos, it is critical that our programs offer high school students exposure to career and technical education, as well as we provide adults with flexible education options in partnership with our community, regional, and state employers. Thank you.
And does that conclude the presentation?
It does.
I'm going to make a request of you, given what we now know about the governor's budget. At some point, I think we need to prioritize what you presented to us here. And what would be your first priority, and then rank them as we go down to assist us as we're going to start making some decisions on the budget. It looks like we will have joint targets with the Senate in March. That would mean that would put us almost 2 months ahead of where we would have been in previous sessions. So as that proceeds, we're going to need your assistance. And I'm going to go back to the joint hearing again. That hearing with K-12 finance, we have to come out of that with some type of a concrete plan that's going to be pushed for the next few sessions as to how we're going to do this relinking with our K-12 system and our high schools. We desperately need to ensure that every high school senior in this state has the option of graduating with an employable skill set if they want it. We did that 30 years ago. I think we can do it again. And you need the enrollment. They need the enrollment. It's time to share resources. And also to go out into the private sector and ask for help. And primarily, I would assume that would be in equipment. So members, any further questions? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Knorr, you have one. And then I'm going to go to Representative O'Neill and then Representative Robbins. We might as well go around the table. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think there's another question that we haven't asked yet. You know, looking at the how we address the free college for students, quite basically it's the last dollar in terms of how we would like to see based on income. Something that I'm more interested in figuring out how we can increase the opportunity for students by having a process where we can support students to pay for college. I don't know if that's something which the Minn State is looking into, or is that something that we should have more conversation? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative, you're probably both. Representative Bonilla.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're thinking about this joint hearing with K-12, I have a couple asks. And I think one of them I talked to you in your office, and one I haven't. And so in relation to the presentation here, we had talked about Pine Technical College coming, because when you look at their enrollment, the per head enrollment, because I think that's more reflective of what's really happening, they were the only one that showed a very, very large increase over the last decade. They had a 47.5% increase in enrollment. And in 2022, they had 2,478 students. And why is that important? Because they're in a very, very small, very rural community, and yet they have this massive draw. So I think we could learn from them. And I happen to know President Joe Mulford, actually, before he was with Minn State, he worked with me on the dual training program. And so he worked a lot because he was working in that aspect too. So I think he would bring a wealth of knowledge. One, like, how did he grow his college so much? And two, he actually has a great intersection between what we're talking about. And he has gone into the high schools nearby, Pine City, Mora, Hinckley, and basically gathered students and brought them into the college. So it'd be interesting to hear his story. I know he has it's already prepared because he's given a presentation in the Senate. The other ask I have is we have one remaining high school that actually is a technical high school, and that's in Wright County, and myself and Representative McDonald represent that, and it's the Wright Technical Center, which is a full high school. I think they would be of great interest to us as well and could offer quite a bit of insight, and they are a co-op for all of Wright County. So I think that would be of great value to this conversation as well, and they they can share their needs as well, but they, because it hasn't been a priority, Mr. Chair, as you well know, over the past decade or two or three even, as it's been declining, their building also is showing that same lack of interest. And so I think they have a great story to tell as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill, in my first conversation with the chair of K-12, she brought up the same point, that we need to see examples of things that work and things that need to be fixed. So we agree with you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have a couple questions about the workforce piece. I have heard for years from manufacturers about how important the Center of Excellence in Manufacturing is and how working with DEED that really does align to workforce needs. So I'm wondering, when that was created, was there savings? Like, did you close programs on other campuses and consolidate things? Did you shift staff? Could you just discuss how that worked, and was there any efficiencies created?
Director Rothschild, you wanted to answer?
Chair Pulaski and Representative. I don't have specific examples of where the centers have replaced staff on campus. I would emphasize that it's an efficiency that's created by having a place where our colleges and universities can work collaboratively to make sure we don't have redundant programs, and where we can listen directly to the voices of our employer community writ large across our entire system, and that permits them to organize the development of curriculum collaboratively so that we don't have redundant programs across our campuses. I'd be happy to ask our center directors for some examples that might specifically address what you've suggested. I would say that especially in the fields of energy, where you have certifications for renewable energy and things like that, you don't need to program it on every single campus. You probably need three programs across the state geographically located. In healthcare, we've created a system for clinical placements through our Center of Excellence. The clinical placement system permits us to organize our employer relationships in a single technology system, where employers can put in their request for clinical students, and our campuses can match those students to the employer needs. Again, the technology was done at the system level, but it serves all our campuses and our communities for clinical placements of healthcare students. Those are just a couple of the examples, but I think we could come up with some really excellent ways to demonstrate that the centers contribute to the efficiency of our system.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you for that. I would appreciate that. I think it would be helpful for the committee if we could see, you know, how many campuses offer the same programs, because looking at where there are redundancies, I'm sort of surprised to hear that maybe there weren't redundant programs closed. So I would like to have a visual or a list of how many different redundant programs there are around, and maybe that's something, you know, that could be considered. My second question, Mr. Chair, is, and I will ask this to all the different systems that come here, but it seems like everyone is coming with enormous budget requests, which I understand there is great need. But what I haven't heard from any of the presentations so far is how you're also coming to the table with places where you are willing to make cuts or make changes. And as speaking for myself only, I guess, I mean, we're looking for partners who are looking to create efficiencies and change operations, not just ask for more money for doing the exact same things over and over again. So I would encourage you to, you know, if you have things in your budget where you are proposing cuts, I would love to see that specified. And if not, you know, I'd like you to perhaps come to a future meeting with some suggestions on where you are looking to partner with us on helping save the taxpayers some money. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just had a question for either the Vice Chancellor or Chancellor Malhotra regarding the 2030, Equity 2030 plan. Now, we don't have a lot of time. We're done at noon, Mr. Chair. So perhaps that's another topic, but it certainly is going to change fundamentally the students and the institutions. But I wondered what the, if you could address the plan, the Equity 2030. I know that I've heard and been reading some skepticism, some concerns, some problematic teachings, and just wanted to know more information on that and what is the impetus of that plan and the cost.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, do you have time? We're getting close to the end here.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, sorry. If we don't have time today, certainly if another meeting would be appropriate.
They'll be coming back.
Okay.
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Chair Pelosi, back to Representative Robbins' question for a second. We do provide in our biennial reporting the reallocation of resources that takes place at our colleges and universities. So continually we are reallocating funds into newer priority activities and to cover inflation. So for fiscal year 21, we reallocated about $39 million, and about 31 of it was used to balance the budget. And in fiscal year 22, $32 million is reallocated with about $20 million to balance the budget, and another $12 million to go into new areas of priority. So I just wanted to mention that data point. Thank you.
And I'm sorry, Representative Vang. I'm sorry. Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a comment. I just want to thank Minnesota State for being here today to give us your presentation and to talk about the state of today's students. I think we are hearing it loud and clear that there is declining enrollment and students are questioning the value of an education. Being a product of public education, especially coming from a community who tend to have more barriers. I see education as the great equalizer. And for students who attend Minnesota State, I recognize that we have a diverse student population with also more diverse needs. And I think it'll be helpful for the committee to know who are the students that we're serving today, especially in Minnesota State. And I could just give an example of my own family. My dad, he attended Hennepin Tech, and it took him 10 years to get his associate's degree simply because he was raising four kids while attending school. So I think, you know, I want to thank the Minnesota State for being more intentional to address the needs of students and looking at how we can at the state to meet that needs too as well. So I do want to encourage you all to continue to invite you all to continue to make the ask from us on what we can do to better meet the needs of students all across the state.
Representative McDonald, you one more thing?
Yeah, just wanted to have that at the next meeting, your program, the Equity 2030 plan. I'd like to hear more about it. I think that would be beneficial for the committee. Wouldn't you agree?
I see they're nodding their heads.
Correct.
So they will. Representative Vang, your comments are well taken, too. So with that, meeting is adjourned.